Okay, so this is going to be a little bit more of a technical talk than the last one, and it will really pick up from some of the themes we heard about yesterday from Michelangelo and Thomas's introduction to the overview of the status of QCD. And this is really quite a large topic, so I apologize in advance if I haven't covered the full extent of next to leading order tools and calculations, Monte Carlo programs. But I'll try and give a flavor, at least, of what's going on in this specific area at the moment. So first of all, I'll tell you what I am going to talk about, and more importantly, what I'm not going to talk about. So I'll be talking about order alpha S corrections to tree-level processes. So that means there's going to be only one virtual loop in these in the diagrams, and we've already heard some next to leading order comments, and we'll hear more about that this afternoon in David's talk. I'm not going to address at all resummation of large logarithms, and again, that's a topic that George Sturman will be covering a little bit later in the day. I won't address power corrections, and I'm not going to talk about matching of next leading order with Parton showers, which Stefano will talk about later. And as Michelangelo pointed out yesterday, all the next leading order programs that I talk about, they're not going to be event generators like lowest order programs such as AlpGen or Herwig or Pythia. They're not going to produce events in that there's going to be a certain weight associated with all these sort of pseudo events that you produce. All these predictions are going to be Parton level only. There's going to be no showering, no hadronization, no detector effects. And of course, since I'm only talking about next to leading order, if there are going to be jets around in these processes, then each jet will have at most two partons inside it. So that's the restrictions. Now, in front of this esteemed audience of many next to leading order experts and practitioners, I'm not going to dwell too much on the benefits of next to leading order and why one should calculate it. But let me just cover a few points very briefly. I've already heard a lot about sensitivity to factorization and renormalization scales that is reduced at next to leading order. It's next to leading order is really the first order in the perturbative expansion where you have a real feel for the normalization of the cross section. So that gives you more accurate estimates of backgrounds, and as also was stressed yesterday, is crucial to interpreting signals for new physics when they appear. And it gives you some confidence that the cross sections that you calculate are under control if you can see that the next leading order corrections do not change the lowest order estimates by a large amount. So in addition to this, there are all sorts of physics reasons for calculating next to leading order. In particular, you begin to see sensitivity to different jet merging schemes, cone algorithms, KT algorithms. You begin to introduce radiation in the initial state at hadron colliders, which means the final state particles get an extra kick, which you don't see at lowest order. And of course, again, at hadron colliders, if you write down the lowest order diagrams for a process, then typically it may only contain quarks and antiquarks. By going to next leading order, you usually introduce gluons into the mix. You may introduce extra effects that that you wouldn't be able to see at all at lowest order. And in addition to all these things, of course, next to leading order is the starting point for a whole plethora of other techniques. If you perform a resummation calculation where you try and resum a large logarithm, then you usually want to try and match this onto a next to leading order calculation. And of course, if you want to do a next to leading order Parton shower, the first thing you better do is actually calculate the next to leading order piece. So if all this is true, and there are all these good reasons for doing next to leading order, and of course we've invested rather a lot of money, and not only money but thought in new upgrades and colliders like Run2 and LHC and hopefully the linear collider to come, then where are we? You know, what have we done? So that's going to be the first section of my talk. I'm going to tell you about what the current state of the art is for next to leading order calculations, and what next to leading order tools are out there that you can get your hands on. And in fact, this came up yesterday, also after one of the talks. One of the questions was, is there a repository out there for experimenters where you can go and you can look up all the next to leading order calculations that have been done, and you can scroll down the list, find the one you want, see who you need to contact, and download the program, read the manual, all these things. And I can only say that, as far as I know, that doesn't exist. And if it had have done, then it would have made preparing this talk a whole lot easier. So believe me, I did look.
You have all the information.
That's right. So after I've described some of the packages that you can use at the moment, I will try and outline briefly why we're lacking next to leading order predictions for many processes that we would like to know at next to leading order. And in some cases, they would be quite crucial to physics measurements. So I'll talk about the methods that that people normally use for doing these calculations, and try and give a flavor of the sort of difficulties that you run into and how to get over them. And I'll finish off with some comments about current directions in the field, which are actually rather different from the traditional methods, and the promising new directions that we'll be going in. So before I get into what the next to leading order frontier looks like at the moment, this is basically a borrowed slide from a Run2 Monte Carlo workshop of a couple of years ago. This is a series of workshops. And this was a wish list for what we'd like to know at next to leading order, broken down into various categories. And the sort of thing that gives you sleepless nights if you're a theorist. Either that or you don't worry about it at all, because you write it off as a madcap scheme. So this is the sort of processes that some people would like to know at next to leading order at hadron colliders. So in the following slides, I'm going to talk about how much of this we know, and where we can tick these off. So I'm just going to go through a bunch of tools that you can use to calculate some of these cross sections at next to leading order. In each case, I will actually try and give the author and a web page and a brief description. So this is a first pass at compiling this sort of a database. So the first one of these is NLO Jet Plus, written by Zoltan Nagy. And here's the web page. And this is a rather ambitious project. As far as I know, I think it's the only one of these suites of programs that's written in C++, so it's already got an advantage in this day and age. And it's ambitious in that it will provide predictions for sort of a linear collider and LEP situations where you need plus or minus annihilation. You can use it for DIS, for HERA, and for hadron-hadron colliders. And it can calculate a number of processes. These are sort of the frontier, so you can calculate E plus E minus annihilation in up to up to a 4 jet. You can calculate EP collisions into a 3 plus 1 jet, and you can calculate 3 jet production at hadron colliders. So just as an example of the sort of thing that you can produce with this program, I've stolen a plot from one of Zoltan's papers, where he shows the ET of the leading jet, the cross-section as a function of the ET of the leading jet, at lowest order and next to leading order. And as we heard about yesterday, the scale dependence of these predictions is reduced when you go from lowest order to next to leading order. And this is shown here by the moving from the gray band, which is lowest order, to the darker black band, which is the next to leading order prediction. So this reduces the uncertainty by a factor of 40% to about 10%. And this is playing the usual game of varying the scale by a factor of 2, which you can, of course, argue about. And another thing that you can see from this plot is that if you take the ratio of the next leading order and leading order curves, it's not flat. There's some dependence on this jet ET. And this shows the power of this sort of differential technique, where you can apply cuts, you can look in particular regions, and you can see how the next leading order corrections affect you there. So that's the first package I wanted to talk about. Here's a slightly different one. The previous package was somewhat generic. This is actually a couple of programs at ILEARN and Emilia, which is a Fortran implementation of gauge boson pair production. And the advance here, compared to previous calculations of 10 years ago or so, is that it includes the full spin and decay angle correlations of the decay products of the W and Z. And in this example here, I've decided to pick the production of a W and a photon. And this is very relevant to searches for anomalous triple gauge boson couplings of the LHC, because if you calculate this cross-section at lowest order, W gamma production, you know that it has a radiation zero at lowest order. So if you look at the difference, if you look at the cross-section as a function of the difference between the W rapidity and the photon rapidity, then it should have a dip at zero rapidity. Now, when you go to next to leading order, that dip is going to be washed out a little bit. That's what you see here. You also, what you observe is actually the photon-lepton rapidity difference, the lepton from the decay of the W. So that also serves to wash out this dip a little bit. And, of course, with the with extra couplings in there, this dip doesn't exist at all. So this is a way to determine whether these sorts of couplings exist by looking for the existence of this dip, which is a standard model, or not. And the further power of this sort of approach is that you can start to apply cuts to these cross-sections. And in fact, you know that if you apply quite a stringent cut on the PT of the lepton, in this case, then that makes the lepton travel in the same direction as the W. So, of course, it serves to restore this dip more and more as if you were looking at the W photon rapidity difference. So, again, it shows the power of this sort of approach. So, another topic is the next leading order corrections to processes involving photons. And in this case, there's another suite of programs. They all have Fox in the name. DiFox, eFox is the appropriate web page. And you can download different packages to calculate different things. And here I've just picked a plot for photon plus jet production in DIS. And this, of course, is very relevant for So here, when the photon radiated from the electron, it's almost real. And here you find that if you look at the rapidity of the photon, that you can get a pretty good agreement with the data in this crossing, in this case. Now, the difficulty with photons, also as we heard yesterday, is that you have to be careful to define them in such a way that they're isolated. And this is a case in point. The best agreement here between the data and the theory actually comes with this blue curve. And here, the next leading order has been corrected for multiple interaction effects, which, when you're talking about photon isolation, is, of course, very important. Because if you have underlying event in there, then what you think is not an isolated photon may very well be one. So, although this isn't purely next to leading order, of course, you need to do that calculation first. So that's sort of where we are with photons. Here's another program, a little bit more in the spirit of the first one I showed, which attempts to collect together a bunch of processes. So you can get predictions for all sorts of things involving vector bosons, Higgs, jets, and heavy quarks. And with this package, sort of the most advanced thing you can calculate is the production of a vector boson in association with two jets, which may or not be heavy quarks. And here the example is is if I look at the W plus BB bar process of the LHC, and I look at the cross section as a function of the BB bar invariant mass, then this is important because there's an associated Higgs production process. I produce a W in association with a Higgs that decays to BB bar. And so this is a very important background for that. And usually I'll want to look in a window of invariant mass, say around about 130 GeV, which is where this this may come into a search strategy. And if I look at the next leading order correction, here's the lowest order curve dotted, and this dashed one is the next leading order correction that I would normally obtain. So it looks pretty grim. The background looks like it's actually somewhat higher in next leading order. But upon inspection, you can see that most of this comes from events which have an extra jet, which you put in there at next leading order. And simply by requiring a jet veto, then you can reduce the next leading order corrections back down to something close to lowest order, and in fact a little bit lower. So once again, this sort of differential approach really gets you something. Now, this has already been talked about, heavy quark production. It will be talked about even more today. So I'm not going to dwell on this either, except to say that all the modern approaches where you include multiple gluon radiation by this FONLL approach and the MC at NLO, it's all based on a package which just includes the next leading order corrections, which you can actually go and download. So once again, this is an example where next leading order on its own may not have been sufficient, but it's the stepping stone to other processes, to other more complicated descriptions. And the other reason I included this is because there really aren't too many calculations which have been performed, including the mass for the heavy quark, and this is one of them. So in that vein, here's another process. This is single top production, for which there were two separate groups performing this calculation that combined. And there's actually no public code for this, but I'm sure you can go and pester any of these people to lend it to you. And they calculated single top production via both of these channels. This double line is the top. And actually the two separate, two little mini groups within this collaboration performed the calculation in different ways. They used something called phase-based slicing and a massive dipole formalism. And of course, the results from the approaches agreed. But the reason I show this plot is because, again, this is a process with a heavy quark, and this massive dipole formalism is fairly new and relatively untested, and it works just fine. Lastly, this is a really rather recent set of calculations for the production of a Higgs boson in association with a heavy quark pair. Two large groups, which I struggled to fit on the slide here. Again, there's no code public at the moment, but I'm sure there will be in the future. And this is just a plot from each collaboration. On the left-hand side, we have the PT distribution of the Higgs. It's been normalized at lowest order and next to leading order. And this is showing you that the shape changes when you go from lowest order to next to leading order. And the plot on the right is just showing the usual reduced scale dependence when going from lowest order of the dash curves to the sonic curves. So this is sort of a frontier calculation in some ways. It's a five-point calculation, and it involves the heavy quark mass. So after going through these examples, where are we on this scorecard that was set up for us 2 years ago? So some of these should be somewhat fainter. On the single boson processes, we're not doing so bad. We're missing these guys at the bottom. We've got picked up a couple in the diboson column. Over here, we're not doing so well at all. None of these guys, and just a handful of these over here. So with that in mind, I'm now going to go on and tell you why there aren't more of these blanks filled in and where we're going. So let me just talk a little bit about how you do a next to leading order calculation. This is only a quick overview. So there are essentially three parts to the calculation. Here are the first two. So we need to calculate virtual diagrams. Here's a tricky guy that's basically as hard as has been done for practical physics applications. So you write down a diagram. You interfere it with a tree amplitude. You have to integrate over the unobserved loop momentum. And because this has divergences, you have to do it in 4 minus 2 epsilon dimensions. And this gives you poles in epsilon. And this is where I'm going to spend most of my talk, because this is really the bottleneck for these calculations. The second piece of the calculation is sort of unhooking this gluon and just letting him radiate. So you have an extra part on, and this has soft and collinear divergences, but you know that when that happens, then these amplitudes factorize into your familiar lowest order matrix element times some splitting function that describes this emission. So in the soft limit, it will be an Iconal factor, or it will be Altarelli-Parisi splitting function. And when you integrate that over soft and collinear phase space, then you also get poles of the opposite sign to these guys. So that brings me to the third piece of the calculation, which is really putting these guys together and putting them in a Monte Carlo in a way that an experimenter can go and change the cuts and get results. So that's all you have to do, then why has progress been so slow? If you look back at the calculation of three jet production in E plus E minus annihilation, then this was basically completed around 1980. And just the mere addition of one tiny jet into the final state added 20 years. So if you're going to extrapolate this even linearly, it doesn't look very good. And if anyone wants to make a bet that it's linear, then I'd be happy to take them up on it, I think. And the reason for this is that as you add more particles into the final state, there are many more scales in the problem. You can't just deal with S and T and U. You add more final states. You've got many more invariants. You can make many more functions. This creates very lengthy analytic expressions. And the loop integrals that you have to do are complicated. And moreover, they're process specific. You can't write a general closed form for all these integrals and just pick out the ones you need. So this is what an integral might look like. So here's just a piece of it. It could be any sort of junk down here where the dashed line is. So you have your propagators, you have external momenta, the p1s, you have internal masses, m1 and m2. And all these integrals are different for the pi squared being different from zero. And of course, this is the situation you're in when you want to talk about W's and Z's and Higgs. And for the internal masses being non-zero, and that's when you want to describe top and bottom and maybe other non-standard model particles. So there's a whole bunch of stuff you have to do here. On top of that, that was just the scalar integral I showed you on the previous slide with just a 1 in the numerator here. Of course, you know that when you actually go to do one of these calculations, because you have fermions, you have non-abelian couplings, and you get much more complicated integrals where you have an L mu up here. You might have an L mu, L nu, L rho, L sigma. And there's a standard technique for dealing with this. You can do a Passerine reduction. You can write these integrals in terms of simpler ones by solving a system of equations, which gets more complicated as you go up to higher point diagrams. And this introduces something called a Gram determinant. And you don't need to know much about this guy, except that it produces very large intermediate expressions. And it can produce spurious singularities. So this is a perfectly fine way of doing things. But as you go to more complicated processes, then it gets exponentially more challenging. So there are other ways of doing these calculations that people have developed. One of these is a unitarity technique, where you make the observation that you can make a one-loop diagram by basically sewing together two tree-level amplitudes and integrating over these guys. And the advantage of this sort of technique is that because you're putting together tree-level amplitudes either side of this cut, you can use tree-level tricks that we know about. You can use helicity amplitudes to simplify things. The structure of these amplitudes is rather simple. So you can actually get rather compact results. And there are all sorts of papers where this is described, and this is a good elementary introduction. However, there are some drawbacks to this technique, and that there are pieces that are hard to construct by using this method. And I'm sure the practitioners would agree that it's not easy to generalize and automate this method. There's some simplification by hand to get these compact results. And I'm sure Lance wouldn't want to calculate 8-point diagrams this way. Maybe not.
Not all.
So what do we do? Well, as I said, there's really very little computational experience with these endpoint integrals beyond n equals 5. It's pentagons. And as was said yesterday, this leaves the next leading order frontier at 2 to 3 processes. There are some special cases of hexagons having been calculated, but not relevant for current collider physics. However, we do know that all integrals with n greater than 4 can be written as a sum of box integrals. And this has been known for some time. There are a number of papers dealing with this subject. And that's fine. You know, you can write these down as boxes, but the analytic result you end up with is a set of poles, as you must, plus a finite part, which is a sum of basically die logarithms and simpler functions like logarithms and rational functions of invariance. But the problem is that as soon as you start to have things like hexagon integrals and you have masses in there, which are the sort of things that you would like to calculate triple W scattering and next to leading order, as soon as you do that, the number of die logarithms you need is greater than 1,000. In fact, it's probably somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000, and probably near the higher end of that. And not only do you then have to get your poor computer to run off and look up the die logarithms in each case, which may well be time-consuming lead to numerical instabilities, there could be large cancellations between these guys that make this, in fact, not a very good thing to do at all. So the technique that a couple of groups have come up with is doing this decomposition all the way down to these functions is not a good idea. Maybe we can implement a numerical method that's just as good or perhaps even better. So I'm just going to describe one of these in outline. And the recipe goes as follows. Here's a hexagon that you want to calculate, of course, in four dimensions, since that's where we live. And you can write that as a sum of 20 triangles, and you know how to write those down, and 15 boxes that happen to live in six dimensions instead of four. Now, what you would normally do in the traditional technique is you can use recurrence relations to write these six-dimensional boxes in terms of box functions that you know about in four dimensions and other triangles. And then you can expand all those boxes and triangles in terms of die logarithms and logarithms. And that's how you get to this thousands of die logarithms that I showed you in the previous slide. Now, they decided to do something different. And instead of doing that, they look at these integrals and do one of these integrations analytically. And that leaves you with a one-dimensional integration you have to do to calculate these triangles and a two-dimensional integral to calculate these boxes. And they perform those integrals numerically by a combination of Monte Carlo techniques and standard numerical integration techniques. And it's using a sector decomposition, which helps ensure numerical stability and simplifies the integrals. And by following this procedure, they're able to calculate the basic integrals that are involved in this sort of a process, which looks formidable. And at this point, I should stress that it's just the integral that's been calculated for this particular diagram for particular points in phase space. It's certainly not the full amplitude for this guy, so don't get too excited. Now, this relies on the fact that you've already isolated the infrared divergences, and you're trying to calculate these finite bits, which of course you can do numerically. So first, you have to come up with a way of splitting off these infrared singularities from the loop integrals. And a way to do this was outlined last year by observing that these singularities occur in the loop integral in two cases. You can either have a massless external particle that splits into two massless lines inside the loop, or you can have two external one-shell particles that exchange a massless particle. And these are known by collinear and soft, just as in the real case. So here's a diagram that might have exactly these sorts of divergences. Here's a massless particle splitting into two massless ones, and here are two massless ones exchanging another one. And these of course give you exactly the 1 over epsilon and epsilon squared poles. And the basic idea here is to identify all these soft and collinear configurations. You can then extract all these infrared poles, and then you're left with just a finite integral that you can go ahead and evaluate in 4 dimensions. And as well as making this sort of numerically tractable, it has other appealing features because you can use techniques that only work in 4 dimensions, where you might worry about things like gamma phi. And the singular pieces are just given in terms of triangle integrals. They're the ones that contain these poles. So back to my example. This is just a simple box diagram. And you can see that if you set the loop momentum to specific values, you can identify the soft singularity where 3 of these propagators vanish. And you can identify the collinear singularities if you write the loop momentum as anything proportional to P1 here. Then you end up with collinear singularities where obviously 2 of these propagators vanish, and you can write this combination in terms of basically a partial fraction then. And this method has already been applied to pentagon integrals. And these are the ones that were involved in the calculation of TT bar Higgs production next to leading order. So it hasn't been used in a really numerical approach yet, but this was useful just to turn the integrals into 4-dimensional ones. So the ultimate goal sort of in this direction is to subtract all these singularities and then do all these loop integrals numerically. And of course, this has many attractive features. Of course, it provides you with a general solution for all sorts of processes, regardless of whether you're talking about a Higgs or a photon on the external lines, whether you have a D quark or a top quark. So it sort of does everything at once. You can have W plus 6 jets, as long as you've got a big enough computer to do it. And in contrast with an analytic approach, the presence of masses should really simplify the procedure rather than making it more complicated, because the singularity structure is much weaker in that case. Now, the remaining problem with this approach is that loop integrals can also contain ultraviolet divergences, which I haven't talked about. But actually, there was a fairly recent paper outlining how one could go about solving this problem. And this was a paper late last year. At the moment, this is sort of limited to the QCD case, where you have all the internal masses set to 0. And the way of doing this is that you write down a counter term for each graph that makes the modified graph, where you've subtracted this counter term, it makes it finite. It leaves you, because you've subtracted these UV singularities, it can make what's left over a bit of a mess. But of course, when you add it up over and sum over all the diagrams, it has to turn into something simple, because you know what the UV structure should be. So there's an outline for how you do this. And you should be able to do the loop integration numerically after that. And at the moment, despite this algorithm existing, there's no, it's a sort of proof of principle. There's no actual concrete example done here. These integrations have not been done numerically yet, although similar things have been done in the past. It's not straightforward. and this I'm sure will be a topic for further study that will be taken up in the coming months of the workshop. So although it looks good, there's really been no implementation so far. So all this has been regarding how one deals with the loop integrals. I'll just say a quick word about the other half of the equation, the real contribution. Now, of course, this should be relatively simple. We know how to calculate tree-level things. We have packages like ALPGEN and MagGraph, MadEvent that can calculate these diagrams and the phase space. And so it looks straightforward. And the methods for dealing with all these soft and collinear singular regions are well-developed. Things like phase-space slicing, subtraction, dipole subtraction, massive dipole subtraction, all under control. However, when you have high multiplicity final states, which after all is sort of the goal of this sort of numerical program, then you end up with a very large number of singular regions. So if you're using this dipole method, you have very many dipoles, which is just another way of saying there are very many singular regions. And this could result in rather time-consuming calculation of all these different subtraction terms. So one might worry that even if one can calculate these very difficult loop integrals, that you'll end up with a very slow program. So I think it's appropriate now to start considering the sorts of things that you could do to speed up these sorts of approaches. And modifications have already been made that that actually limit the subtraction region, speed up the code. And I think that's something that deserves further attention and will probably also be addressed in this workshop. So let me depart from this traditional methods and extensions to numerical approaches by talking about something really quite different. And this is an attempt recently to try and construct infrared finite amplitudes where you don't have to worry about any of this regularization and you end up with finite amplitudes throughout. And of course you get very, very many benefits from that. It's completely straightforward to implement it in a numerical way. You have easy matching to a parton shower. And of course, it sounds great, but you've got to actually do it. This is where we are at the moment, where we talk about S matrix elements in our regular Fock space, and this has soft and collinear divergences. And what we want to move to is something which has an order by order dressing of the states, including all long range interactions, which should then be free of infrared divergences. And this sort of order by order dressing is a sort of a reordering, sort of very much like the sort of thing you would do in resumming soft gluons. But in this paper, this is sort of a new way of looking at it to try and use this sort of a method to construct finite amplitudes. And the basic idea behind this is that normally, if you go back to basic construction of your quantum field theory, you normally assume that in the far distant future and past that you can approximate your full Hamiltonian by free states acted on by the free Hamiltonian. And we know that this assumption is just not true in QCD. Because we have these gluons, they have very long range interactions that don't vanish sufficiently quickly in this limit. And so the method the authors of this paper follow is to introduce an asymptotic Hamiltonian that should contain exactly all these long-range interactions and replace this assumption with this one. So you have new states, you have a new asymptotic Hamiltonian that you have to calculate that should include these soft and collinear splittings. And you can end up with finite amplitudes. It's not straightforward, but there are diagrammatic rules, which are similar to the Feynman rules, and end up being time-ordered. And so far, it's only been demonstrated on a test case. So this is E plus E minus to two jets. It's about the simplest thing you can think of. So there's no hadronic initial state, there's no Chippel-Gluon coupling, it's not a very high multiplicity in the final state, but it sort of lays out a method that could be pursued. And I think this is certainly something that could also benefit from further study. So let me summarize now. And of course, next leading order tools are invaluable for understanding results from experiments. They will continue to be so in the future. There are many tools out there at the moment, and I've broken these down into a couple of classes, ones where the authors have the code, ones which calculate a specific process, and ones which attempt to be a little bit more generic and addressing a variety of processes. And I should stress that despite the recent heroic progress towards next to leading order, there's still much left to be done at one loop. We shouldn't forget about it, and I'm sure we won't, but there is much still to be calculated. And I just wanted to add some outlook for the workshop to try and set the scene a bit. And of course, I don't think anyone's expecting people to do any of these next to leading order computations on the timescale of the workshop. Usually it takes a little bit longer than that. However, it might be a good opportunity to try and think about the sorts of predictions that we might like to know in next to leading order. For instance, are there calculations which could be done where we know the technology and they could be done on a relatively short timescale? And an example here is WQQ bar production retaining the quark mass. And this is a sort of a just beyond the frontier calculation. We know how to calculate this when this quark mass is zero. And we know how to calculate this when this W is a Higgs. So in some sense, it's a little step beyond what we already know. And should we be doing that? If we should be doing that, should we be doing it using existing techniques? Or is it time to have a cultural revolution and come up with something new? And also, what are the improvements we can make to the systems that we already know about? How do we improve slicing and subtraction procedures, in particular coping with all these singular regions? How do we come up with a numerical approach to loop integrals? How do we actually do those numerical integrations? And of course, since it's been a holy grail for some time to come up with a merging between next to leading order and parton showers, I think in order to make Stefano's life easier, we should think about how to better integrate upcoming results with these new approaches. Maybe there's a suitable way to prepare these corrections. So let me end with just a longer term outlook by saying that I think it's clear that doing next leading order calculations on a case-by-case basis is not going to happen in the future. And an automated approach using an algebraic, some algebraic techniques and using numerical integration seems to be the way of the future. And maybe we'll have an ALPGen at next to leading order, or I think I might trademark this one. I rather like Mad Loop. Maybe that's sometime in the future. And at this point, I have to be a little bit careful because I don't want to put myself or anyone else out of a job. So even if this sort of ambitious project can be realized, then that's not the end of the story. The interpretation and grooming of the results is still going to be very process specific, dealing with things like photons, where you have to worry about extra fragmentation effects, isolation. You might have to worry about threshold effects, jet clustering, all sorts of resummation. There are other things to consider, and I don't think a robot's going to put me out of my job quite yet. Thank you.
column dedicated to 3-gauge boson production. So do we have an idea of how that is really useful? I mean, presumably that is to measure a quartic coupling, an anomalous quartic coupling. How well is that done at Tevatron?
That's a good question. I mean, I think this wish list is somewhat fanciful. I think for the purposes of illustration, it was it's fine. But I think obviously there needs to be some dialogue between experimenters and theorists to decide really what is what we do need to know and what how many of these things are what we would like to know in an ideal situation. Probably these triple boson final states are not one of the high priorities. But things like W plus 3 jets, W plus 4 jets, which are crucial backgrounds to top studies, they are crucial.
One question.
So I also think that the numerical methods presumably not too far future may solve this problem. There is this Japanese program, do you know about it, which calculates electrolytic processes that one loop completely numerical. And they've been applied to some non-trivial cases. And they built this program too early and far not optimal. But they can really produce some numbers which is impressive. If you are very optimistic, I can imagine that by the time LHC will operate, this Abgen NLO or MED loop may exist.
Yes, that's, I agree. And I meant to stress that now's the time to be thinking about these things. Obviously, the time scale isn't next week or next month, but we should be thinking about all these things now so that they are ready when the LHC turns on in a few years' time. And there may well be interaction with these processes which are a little bit outside the QCD realm, QED and weak interaction, where we can learn things, especially in these numerical techniques.
One of the last things you mentioned about attempting to get rid of the infrared divergences with redefinition of the states sounds a lot like the coherent state formalism in QED. It was introduced about 30 years ago or so. First, is it roughly the same? And secondly, in that case, I don't know of any practical applications. It's sort of conceptually a nice idea, but what does it sort of buy for you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the approach is built on these older QED approaches. And there is, as you say, there's a lot of literature going back 20 years where people tried exactly this sort of thing for QED. And at the end of the day, in this test case, E plus E minus to 2 jets, really all you're seeing is QED. I mean, there is no triple knot coupling in there. So I think a crucial thing for that approach is to extend it to something a bit more realistic. Make it QCD or make it a Hadron collider. And then we'll see if it buys you anything. I think the jury is still out on whether the extra work you put in to do this really buys you anything at the end of the day.
Yeah. One thing you didn't mention, long before you were born, there was a mini industry in the very early days of the subject where people tried to second guess the size of the corrections. They looked at big pi squareds or logs or whatever, on the grounds that, well, all you really needed to know, are the corrections big and therefore I have to do them, or are they small, therefore, doesn't matter. From all this experience of these calculations that have been done so far, is there any knowledge that has been gained about the size of corrections in some general or generic way? I mean, which ones are the big ones, which ones are the small ones, and can you, as I say, second guess calculations that haven't yet been done?
I don't think there's really been a a systematic look at that sort of thing. I certainly know people that have been interested and have asked me what's the K factor for this process and this process. Can I extrapolate it to this one? And I think at the end of the day, you have to say that's a very dangerous thing to do. There aren't too many examples where the K factor has been very large. Things like inclusive Higgs production at the LHC is one of the ones where obviously this K factor was large, but most other places it's been quite small. But I would stress again that it's very dependent on the sort of cuts that you apply. And particularly in the era of LHC physics, where people are talking about doing forward tagging of jets and these sorts of searches, it's very dangerous to apply an overall K factor to a very specific region of phase space.
Just to follow up, James's
remark, even when there are very large K factors, I think quite often they don't really come from this bottleneck piece, the virtual correction after doing the subtractions. And you might be able to get some approximate information on those terms through some of the building something that might have the right cuts and right collinear behavior and ignoring stuff that isn't singular in those regions.
Yeah.
Depending on how hard you want to work, you could stop at earlier stages and see how that does. First on processes where you know the exact answer.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's my personal experience as well. But, it's the extra sort of real radiation that often is responsible for that.
Joey, last question.
Actually, this might be more of maybe
Stefano is going to cover this in his talk, but you had mentioned trying to perhaps formulate a way for these calculations to be able to more easily include it at MC and NLO. I mean, is there any understanding of what might be done to make that possible, or is it really Herwig that's the problem?
I think that to some extent it's people that do these next linear order calculations probably need to go and learn a little bit about Herwig and how it works and how to present the results in a useful form. That may well be the best thing to do for a little while, is to sort of update something like MC at NLO with the important processes that aren't in there and that would be very useful for experimental study.
Let's stop the discussion here, otherwise we are really having not enough time for the break. We come back at 10 past 11. Let's thank John again.